Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, November 15th, 2024. We begin with page one, where the main story is a collage of holiday-themed photos titled All Decked Out, and the caption reads, Guest services employees work on getting the gift store ready for the holidays Thursday at the Children's Discovery Museum at 101 East Beaufort Street in Normal. You can visit childrensdiscoverymuseum.net to see more information about upcoming events. And decorated trees are part of the festive atmosphere in the museum. And there are photos of employees wrapping gifts and beautiful decorated trees in the museum. Our main story on page one is about Illinois, titled Pension Fakes Hard and Costly for the State, Federal Rules and Worker Unrest and Deficit Shake Tears Created in 2011. This is a Chicago Tribune story datelined Springfield. As a nurse in her 30s, Kristen Perez cringes at the prospect of working until she's almost 70. But because of changes made to the state's massively underfunded pension system 13 years ago, employees like Perez, who were hired by the state after the changes took effect, do not qualify for the same retirement benefits as her longer-tenured colleagues with the Illinois Nurses Association. This creates a second class of state workers that sows division, Perez said Wednesday during a rally at the Illinois State Capitol of thousands of unionized teachers, first responders, and other public employees seeking changes to the state's pension system. Investing in state workers and delivering a fair and equitable pension for all the state workers, this is essential to meet the needs of the state and all the communities we all serve. At issue are concerns over reforms made to Illinois' beleaguered pension system in 2011. Workers hired after that date were placed into a Tier 2 system that offered reduced benefits. The overall goal of creating the Tier 2 plan was to shrink a pension debt that now runs to $141 billion. But at some point, benefits paid out under the system will not equal won't equal to what Social Security would provide to those employees, a violation of a federal safe harbor law. That would require the state to pay large sums in Social Security taxes instead of operating its own pension system, which, while still costly, allows the state more flexibility. This week, bills were introduced in both the Illinois House and Senate that are intended to address the Tier 2 issue. Advocates caution without meaningful changes, there will be a continued shortage of public service employees because of difficulty in hiring and retention. With the state projecting a budget deficit next year that could exceed $3 billion, however, the cost of making those changes presents a significant challenge. The fact is that what we need to do is make sure that we are meeting the Social Security safe harbor minimum. So that's something that has not been fully calculated, Governor J.B. Pritzker said at an unrelated event in Springfield on Wednesday. But it is clear that it needs to be dealt with because otherwise you create a whole other liability for the state. The pension problem is a major political issue for Pritzker and the Democrats, who control the General Assembly and count on organized labor as one of their top allies. A fix to the issue could conceivably cost billions of dollars spread out over several years. A coalition of public service unions want to see the Tier 2 employees' final average salary, pension calculation, and retirement ages in line with the previous Tier 1 system, as well as across-the-board 3% simple interest cost of living adjustments for all Tier 2 retirees. The coalition also called for adjusting the pension salary cap to match the Social Security wage base. Those adjustments are reflected in the bills introduced this week by two Democrats, Representative Stephanie Kifewit of Aurora and Senator Robert Martwick of Chicago. Martwick said if a regular person planned for their retirement, they should aim for replacing 85% of their previous year's salary, which should be able to grow with inflation. But Tier 2 benefits are roughly half of a beneficiary's last salary, he said. In terms of planning for our public sector employees' retirement, we're giving them a terrible benefit that gets worse and then has so many negative consequences, Martwick said. On the one hand, for those who recognize that, a lot of them are leaving, and so we have a shortage of employees. On the other hand, for those who stay and retire on that benefit, they're going to receive such a shock to their overall quality of life. Illinois' pension woes are decades old and have proven a central obstacle for governors and legislatures in balancing the state's budget each year. In 1994, the pension system was in such tatters that Democrats and Republicans came together on a solution in what was billed at the time as an extraordinary measure. The agreement required a steady stream of payments over the next 50 years that would force the General Assembly to fulfill its constitutional obligations to hundreds of thousands of state employees. The plan called for the state pension system to reach a 90% funding level by 2045, but the law backloaded major state payments and was sometimes ignored, and the system fell deeper into debt. In 1997, the pension system's unfunded liability was $13.7 billion, and by 2010, it had reached $85.6 billion. That year, the General Assembly made changes to the pension code, resulting in the emergence of the Tier 2 system, with a goal of cutting costs long-term by lowering benefits for those hired after January 1, 2011. At the time, the move was projected over the next three decades to lower the state's contributions by more than $70 billion and cut the total pension liabilities nearly in half by $256 billion. Experts on the teacher retirement system, the state's largest government retirement fund, have cautioned Tier 2 benefits would begin to fall out of compliance by 2027 because of a limit on the benefits and inflation adjustments that would be much tighter than those adopted by Social Security. This would risk leaving retirement benefits for some workers to fall below what they could qualify for under the federal system. Supporters saw the bills that were introduced in the General Assembly as a way to jumpstart consideration of the pension problem by lawmakers, but the measures are not expected to be considered in the short fall veto session this month due to the complexity of the issue and cost concerns. Lawmakers will reconvene in January for a lame duck session before a new General Assembly is sworn in. And our last front page story is headlined, Mummy's Mystery Unwrapped, sort of. Masked purveyors of mystic funk talk before their castle show. This story is Dateline Bloomington. Conspiracies and music can steer barroom conversations of pop culture like a snake chasing its own tail. Whether it's the blood-curdling scream in Love Roller Coaster by the Ohio Players or alleged sightings of Elvis Presley after his 1977 death, discerning truth from fiction can be hard when beats turn mystique. One of the funkiest mysteries to ever drum up a groove is set to get music fans shaking to wickedly good funk music next weekend. Here Come the Mummies is coming November 23rd to the Castle Theater in Bloomington. The eight-piece band, Untombed Late Last Century in Nashville, is bringing the rhythm, horns, and ghastly groovy funk rock to the Twin Cities. They not only know how to throw down the funk, but they also put on a show that will give you goosebumps like in the 1986 movie Little Shop of Horrors. In this column, I won't do a deep dive into who these hair raisers and belly shakers really are, and if rumors of Grammy Award winners truly are shielded within this creepy yet charismatic cohort. Perhaps there are mild-mannered musicians hidden under those wraps. It's just more fun to believe funky horrors beyond comprehension are actually running the show. What I do know from my research is that their harmonies are monumental, their spirits are juiced, and their eyes are locked on the beat. After all, band member Midnight does have a large, hairy eyeball towering over his baritone saxophone. Here Come the Mummy's success can be gauged by the expansive discography they've built over more than two decades, starting with the 2000 release of debut album Terrifying Funk from Beyond the Grave. They've been suspending reality with style at their shows, with the album's intro track Believe in Things You Cannot See. And later on in the album, they strum into a fiery string fiesta in the song Ra Ra Ra. Their repertoire over the years has shown that Here Come the Mummies can fuse musical genres into a spellbinding frenzy. Wicked Never Rest on the 2016 album A Blessing and a Curse is a song that speeds into snazzy guitar riffs like in the Clash track Rock the Casbah. How these mummified musicians have managed to play with their personas under wraps for so long continues to mystify me. But how they've managed to steep legendary levels of musicianship in fantasy Hollywood show themes is a tale perhaps too quixotic to fit into newsprint. Some secrets are truly better kept in the shadows. The real question to me, Mummy Mummy on the stage, who is most prepared to rage? And in an email interview offered on the condition of anonymity so as not to spoil their wildly crafted stage characters, our writer heard from Mummy Cass, guitarist and vocalist, and Midnight on the following 14 questions. Why do you wish to keep your identities shrouded in mystery after more than two decades? And Mummy Cass answers, Baby, when we were cursed 4,000 plus years ago, we ceased to be who we were in the first place, but over the years, we've come up with nicknames for ourselves like Midnight, Eddie Mummy, and Dr. Yo. Does the mystery help keep the magic of freakishly good music alive? Mummy Cass says, Definitely. People are free to project their wildest fantasies onto us. We're happy to help. What would happen if I saw the uncovered faces of Here Come the Mummies? Would my face melt into a misty haze like Major Toad from Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark? Answer, best to not, buddy. So what's life or afterlife like on the roll? Oh, and when's the Egypt tour? Mummy Cass says, we like to keep moving. We like to be where the action is. It beats centuries of darkness with only the sound of sand shifting in the wind. Before you were excavated from a Nashville recording studio, how did you end up covered in wraps and why? And Mummy Cass says, We got mummified by the Pharaoh's curse. Now, if you try to pull the fabric away, our bones would turn to dust and you'd be left with nothing. Whether it was for 4,000 years or 40,000, how did you spend the time lolling around? Did you learn any new instruments? Mummy Cass says that would have been plenty of time to practice if we had been anything like alive all that time. Tell me about your show preparation routine. What does it take to raise Here Come the Mummies? Midnight Mummy says, Vodka and five-hour energy is a hell of a drug. That plus seven cups of really stout coffee. Do not try that at home. Seriously. Which band member provides the most comedic relief on your music journey? Mummy Cass says, We all get in on that, especially when we're all punchy toward the end of a long tour. Aside from Grammy Awards, are there any other illustrious awards Here Come the Mummies are rumored to have that people might not be aware of? Anything goes, mountains climbed, hot dog eating contests, video game high scores, etc. Mummy Cass says, Midnight won most likely to in school way back in ancient times. The what we never could decipher. He does have a giant eyeball living on his top hat, you know. Maybe that was it. Let's relive the release of your debut album, Terrifying Funk from Beyond the Grave. Did you have any sense a funk jam like Eternity would be so sweet it seemingly could last forever? Mummy Cass says, Oh, we knew. That's why that song is like 8 minutes long. Here Come the Mummies' funk has hints of several styles, from classic funk in single, double, triple, to Latin fusion in Ra 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 and driving funk rock in Devil Better Run on the album Cryptic. What prompts Here Come the Mummies to diversify its sound across these genres? Mummy Cass says, "We're just making the music we hear in our heads, no matter what style. As we wander the earth for eternity, we gotta keep it fresh." And Midnight says, "We do not smell fresh, though." Before the devil went down to Georgia, did Here Come the Mummies make a deal with the devil to acquire their talents? Mummy Cass says, "Contrary, we were talented as hell before we got cursed by the Pharaoh. And not just at music, baby, you dig?" Which one of your horns grabs the most attention and why? And do Here Come the Mummies often play horn solos like in Everything But on Cryptic? Mummy Cass says, "Most if not all of the solos are made up on the spot. We've got a lot of good improvisers in the band. Dr. Yo probably gets the most attention owing to the sheer size of the berry and the force he blows with." 2 decades is a long time to keep some sick grooves going for. How long do you think Here Come the Mummies will stay banded for until the time comes to wrap things up? Mummy Cass says, 2 decades is nothing to us. We're in our 25th year of the modern age, but our 467nd on the planet. And Midnight says, I thought it was our 4,754th. And we turn now to some local and state news. This story is headlined, Aquifer Bill Heard on Hold. Lawmakers ask for more input on plan to ban CO2 wells. This story is Dateline Springfield. A bill that would ban carbon sequestration activity within the footprint of the Mahomet Aquifer received its first legislative hearing on Wednesday, but failed to advance as state lawmakers seek more input on an issue some view as existential. "I think it is most important that we get this right," said Senate President Don Harmon, Democrat of Oak Park, adding that he viewed the hour-long Senate Executive Committee hearing as the beginning of a very critical conversation. The legislation filed earlier this fall by State Senator Paul Faraci, Democrat of Champaign, comes as lawmakers grapple with how to ensure the aquifer, the sole water source for more than 800,000 people across much of east-central Illinois, is protected, while a nascent carbon capture and sequestration industry eyeing Illinois due to favorable geology gets off the ground. Lawmakers passed and Governor J.B. Pritzker signed legislation earlier this year that built upon and filled gaps in existing federal regulations to carbon capture and sequestration. This included key protections such as 2-year moratorium on pipeline construction, extra permitting requirements, and safety provisions. But left unaddressed was whether protections would be enacted to prevent carbon injections thousands of feet underneath sole source aquifers. The designation is significant as it indicates an aquifer that supplies at least 50% of the drinking water for the region and that there is no reasonable alternative source should it become contaminated. The Mahomet Aquifer is the only EPA-designated sole source aquifer in Illinois. The push for carbon capture and storage is an essential part of our broader strategy to combat climate change and move forward toward a sustainable future, Faraci said. However, we must balance innovation and progress with vigilant protection of our natural resources. Concerns grew a few months ago when Archer Daniels Midland Company was cited by the U.S. EPA in August for injection activity not allowed under its federal carbon sequestration permit and for violating the Safe Drinking Water Act. The agribusiness giant, which has been injecting carbon underneath its Decatur facility for more than a decade, discovered in March that injected carbon seeped from a corroded monitoring well pipe into the ground about 5,000 feet below the surface. Though thousands of feet below any drinking water sources, it was 500 feet above where ADM is permitted to inject carbon. ADM later paused carbon injections at its Decatur site after tests revealed a seepage of fluids from a second monitoring well. That pause is still in effect. The company holds the only permit to inject carbon in the entire state, and it is not within the footprint of the Mahomet Aquifer. However, there are applications for 22 carbon injection well applications in Illinois that are in the pipeline, according to the U.S. EPA, and some of those are within the aquifer's footprint and could be approved as early as 2025. Experts on carbon capture and sequestration who testified on Wednesday said that the risk of a carbon well leak impacting water wells, which are hundreds of feet deep compared to the thousands of feet for carbon storage sites, is very, very low. To date, PRI has found no evidence of negative impacts of carbon storage to the groundwater supply, said Mark Miller, deputy director of the Prairie Research Institute and the university at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. This, however, did not cut with lawmakers representing areas within the aquifer, nor with environmental advocates and many residents within the footprint who say that a very low risk is too much risk. The point here is we shouldn't have any risk, said State Senator Chapin Rose, Republican of Mahomet. There's no acceptable risk because this is the sole source. Farachi said that the status of the aquifer as it relates to carbon sequestration is probably the number one issue he hears about from his constituents. The bill is supported by environmental groups like the Illinois Environmental Council and Sierra Club. The town of Normal in McLean County, through their contract lobbyists, also slipped in support. The Illinois Farm Bureau is neutral. It is opposed by business groups such as the Illinois Manufacturers Association and the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, as well as the Illinois Soybean Growers Association and the powerful Local 150 Operating Engineers Union. Donovan Griffith, the IMA's Vice President of Governmental Affairs, encouraged lawmakers to slow things down, noting that the carbon capture legislation that was approved earlier this year was the product of years of conversations and months of painstaking negotiations between a wide range of interest groups. There's no need to pass this today, Griffith said. As has been described, there is no carbon sequestration happening under the Mahomet Aquifer. None is going to be happening tomorrow. I think we have some time to, again, do that due diligence, have those conversations. Farachi said he plans to start those conversations this week. This is not an overnight kind of fix, and there are a lot of parties that are concerned and interested in getting this done right, Farachi said. And our next story is headlined, Rivian and Volkswagen Finalize Partnership, $5.8 billion joint venture for software seen as win for automakers. This story is by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Electric vehicle startup Rivian and German automobile giant Volkswagen finalized their joint venture this week, a $5.8 billion deal that could prove transformational for both automakers. They are partnering to develop software for their next-generation electric vehicles through a separate entity helmed by top Rivian and VW officials. Called Rivian and VW Group Technology LLC, the joint venture provides Volkswagen access to Rivian's technology platform while juicing the startup's balance sheet as it aims to make the jump to being a profitable company. Rivian CEO R.J. Scaringe previously said the capital investment will help support the launch of a new R2 crossover at its factory in Normal, where the company has more than 8,000 workers, and help make its planned $5 billion factory an hour east of Atlanta a reality. Certainly, this partnership and this deal secures the capital for us to ensure that we can not only take Rivian through the launch of R2 in Normal, but secures the launch and growth of our Georgia facility through becoming a free cash flow positive business, he reiterated in a statement on Tuesday. Volkswagen Group CEO Oliver Blume said, "The partnership with Rivian is the next logical step in strengthening our global competitive and technological position." The joint venture will be led by Vasim Benside, Rivian's chief software officer, and Karsten Helbing, VW Group chief technical engineer. The joint venture staff will be comprised of developers and software engineers from both companies who will begin their partnership work Wednesday. Teams initially will be based in Palo Alto, California, near San Francisco, about 400 miles northwest of Rivian's headquarters in Irvine, California, in suburban Los Angeles. Three other sites are in development in North America and Europe. "We are thrilled to see our technology being integrated in vehicles outside Rivian," Scaringe said. "This is an important enabler to help accelerate EV adoption." The companies also said they'll be able to reduce development costs and more efficiently scale their new technologies by combining their efforts. In addition to supporting Rivian's R2 launch in the first half of 2026, the partnership will support the first VW electric models as early as 2027. The intention to form a Rivian-VW joint venture first came to light in June. Then valued at $5 billion, the partnership was sold as a way to improve each automaker's weaknesses, helping with Rivian's manufacturing and experience and VW's lagging tech platform. It is a point both companies hit Tuesday when finalizing the deal. "It is highly complementary, reflecting Rivian's industry-leading software and electrical hardware technology, as well as Volkswagen Group's significant global scale and industry-leading vehicle platform competencies," the company said in a news release. Rivian's flagship R1 fleet of trucks and SUVs has racked up awards, but the company has struggled with supply chain issues and has seen its cash pile shrink. That prompted the company in March to pause its planned Georgia factory, the state's second-largest economic development project, as a cost-cutting measure which saved the automaker more than $2 billion in the short term. Scaringe said the Georgia plant, which Rivian has promised will employ 7,500 workers in southern Morgan and Walton counties, remains a vital part of Rivian's scaling efforts. To land the factory, state and local officials offered the company a $1.5 billion incentive package, most of which only comes to fruition after the automaker delivers its investment and employment promises. VW said it already has invested an additional $1 billion in Rivian, taking an equity position in the startup and becoming one of the company's largest investors. VW will invest an additional $1.3 billion as consideration for background intellectual property licenses and a 50% equity stake in the joint venture. The remaining $3.5 billion investment is expected to consist of equity, convertible notes, and debt at future dates and based on clearly defined milestones by 2027, the company said in a release. Volkswagen in recent years has struggled to develop EV software and has fallen behind many of its competitors. Those losses are taking their toll, with several media outlets reporting in October that VW plans to close as many as three of its German factories. The Rivian-VW joint venture will develop what the companies called next-generation software-defined vehicle platforms. They are vehicles that can be updated over time using software improvements. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Panograph of Friday, November 15th, 2024. I look forward to reading part two with you next.